May it please the court.
Hold on just one moment. Restart that clock. We have people coming here. All right, Mr. Miller, you may proceed.
Thank you. In this case, we ask that you vacate the judgment of the trial judge and reverse and direct judgment in favor of Chris Edmond for the following reasons. The law in Virginia has never permitted the creation of a will with just oral statements of intent, nor does the law, in our view, in Virginia, permit the restoration of a revoked will based on oral statements of intent.
But that's not what the trial court held. The trial court held that the evidence was sufficient to rebut an equitable presumption. That's all. That's not creating an oral will out of scratch. It's just rebutting a presumption.
Well, I respectfully disagree because, first of all, the judge relied on Bowery, which sets forth the incorrect standard. So the judge starts with a incorrect standard, and then if you review the evidence, you will only see evidence of statements of intent.
So a Virginia Supreme Court case has an incorrect standard in it? That's the court's opinion.
Well, Judge, I have several answers to that question. The first one is Bowery did not address what is in every other case. Bowery did not address the requirement that the person seeking to overcome the presumption, the absolute requirement stated over and over and over again, to assign and prove some other cause for the disappearance of the will. Bowery does not address that issue, does not say it, but in three subsequent Bowery cases, you have a situation where this court has restated that a absolute requirement to overcome the presumption of revocation is to assign and prove some other cause for the disappearance.
Now, is that really a fair statement? Because it's not that these later cases, which are cutting and pasting this language, say there's an absolute requirement that the rebuttal case is limited to one narrow fact question. I mean, historically, the rebuttal was simply saying that obviously he did not revoke this will. We presume he must have because we couldn't find it afterwards, but the evidence is overwhelming, clear and convincing, that he didn't. Isn't that the whole point of the equitable doctrine and the fact that we have repeated, we'd like to know if anyone can tell us what happened to the original? And that would certainly rebut it, but that's not the exclusive means of rebutting it.
Well, I disagree because if you look at the court studies, the three post-Bowery cases, you start with Sutherland, where the trial court said that the will, the presumption had been over.
But this court never said we were reversing our earlier cases. So if you read them all together, we're just looking at common sense ways of rebutting what appears to be a presumption.
Well, I disagree because Bowery does not ever address the issue of assigning a separate cause, which is an essential element of the court, as the court has said in subsequent cases.
Was Bowery decided incorrectly?
I think the court has answered that question in the subsequent cases. It was either...
What did we say?
You never cited Bowery for the proposition that statements of intent are enough.
Well, suppose that's not overruling a case. Are you saying that Bowery is incorrect?
It's either incorrect, yes, or you have implicitly overruled it in subsequent cases, which is certainly something that can be done, implicit overruling of cases. It's never been cited for this proposition again. And the Bowery case contains no analysis of the assigning of some other cause for the disappearance. There's no discussion of that standard. All you have in Bowery is evidence of deep affection, reported statements of leaving belongings to a proponent. You have a very specific statement 3 weeks before the day of death of the existence of a specific will. Bowery has some very specific statements in it. Bowery was either incorrectly decided or should not be followed as precedent because it does not contain a careful, deliberate analysis of the issues that are required. I point out that in Bowery, the people, the opponents of the will apparently did not testify or present any evidence below. Bowery is, in our view, an outlier. But whether it's wrongly decided, an incomplete decision that should not be given precedential value, or implicitly overruled, frankly, I think is maybe perhaps above my pay grade to pick among those three, but I would suggest that to the court that Bowery cannot form the basis of your decision. If Bowery forms the basis of your decision going forward, not only are you rejecting the three post-Bowery cases, but you are then setting up the following dichotomy. You cannot in Virginia create a will by oral statements, but you can in Virginia restore a will that has been revoked.
No, that's been presumed to be revoked. You can rebut the presumption. You're not restoring a revoked will. That's the logic I'm not following in what you're saying.
In our view, a revoked will is no will at all.
But it's only presumed revoked. It's not revoked. It's presumed revoked.
That's right.
And so what you're dealing with is a presumption and the rebuttal of that presumption. And also, you seem to think that our post-Bowery cases somehow overruled Bowery, but Bowery cited in those cases. In Sutherland, we cite the Bowery.
It's an interesting cite in the Sutherland case. In that case, the Supreme Court says the opponents have said Bowery and another case, I think it's Jackson, support our proposition. If the present case, Sutherland, doesn't rise to the level of Bowery and the Jackson case, then they lose. It's really not endorsing Bowery, but
there was an invitation to say, well, it's no longer applicable. We didn't say that.
I would suggest that if Bowery, if the court believes Bowery is good law, that the nature and circumstances of the statements in that case are much different than in this case. There's very specific statements about the existence of a will and the specifics of the will. And
can I ask this last question? Suppose this hypothetical, that the day, the morning of the day that Jimmy Edmonds passed away, he did a video recording. And the video recording said, as everyone knows, I have put together the appropriate documents to leave my estate to my wife and my daughter, Kelly. And as everyone already knows, I don't intend any other beneficiaries in the estate. And you can find the paperwork in my file cabinet. And then he dies after the video. Am I interpreting your point correctly if the answer to that kind of hypothetical would be, oh, but he didn't say what happened to the original, and all we have is a copy, so therefore we're not going to enforce it?
It's a much different scenario.
To be sure.
It is closer to the cases that discuss the fact that the decedent, in one case, the decedent said, here's my will, I think it was to the pastor, here's the will, 2 days, and this is what it provides for. 2 days later, he becomes incapacitated. Two weeks later,
obviously, what I'm thinking is, if I'm understanding your argument, the legal and logical answer to that hypothetical is, he didn't say anything about where the original was, what happened to it, or anything. Therefore, since that's an absolute requirement, as you suggest, we can't enforce the copy of the will. We can't probate it. That just seems not intuitive to me.
Under Bowery, if it was that strong of evidence, one could make the argument that under Bowery, you have to have that level of specificity and no lapse of time, no opportunity to access the will.
You couldn't make the argument if your legal interpretation of the standard were correct, which is it's an absolute requirement that the rebuttal evidence specifically identify the reasons we are suspecting that the document has been lost.
And perhaps we're ships passing the night, for which I'll accept responsibility. We never say in our papers, contrary to the appellee's position, that a specific cause, exactly what happened to the will, has to be proven, nor do we say that you have to show that a specific person accessed the will. That's not the standard. You have to identify some other cause other than revocation for the loss of
change. Okay, we're not passing it tonight. Under that interpretation of the rule, my hypothetical would be we don't probate that will.
Mr. DeMuro, you know that these cases are often very fact-specific. They arise under circumstances that are unusual, involving families and other people, and unusual circumstances surrounding not only the storage of wills, but the last days of somebody's life. And I've read all these cases that both sides have cited again. And the truth of the matter is I find some things that are inconsistent even within the cases. One of the cases you cite, for example, Hardin, it's Brown versus Hardin.
Yes.
And you cite it for the proposition, and I find exactly where the proposition is contained. The burden is on those who seek to establish such an instrument to assign and prove some other cause for its disappearance. And that's your position. And that actually comes from Tate versus Wren and Shacklett versus Roller as well. In the same case, the opinion of the court says it was not incumbent upon Ms. Hardin to prove that the will was destroyed or suppressed by any certain person, nor specifically what became of said will, and that she only had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Cherix did not destroy the will with the intention of revoking it. I mean, that's in the same case.
I think I can square those.
Well, I'd love to hear you do it.
The burden of, and this is the case I was speaking to Judge Justice Kelsey about, we don't say, and Brown doesn't say that you have to prove a specific person took the will or specifically what happened to the will. But in Brown, the most significant fact, and I think that's a quote, in the decision, and now I'm paraphrasing, the papers were taken by an interested sister and niece within 36 hours of death. That creates some other plausible cause for the loss or taking of the will, that the sister who was disinherited under the will takes, I think she had her daughter, the niece, take the papers. And that's an explanation. That's an explanation that affirmed Brown. In Harris, the second case after Bowery, the trial court found that the will was lost or taken based on a claim that the decedent had no access to the will because the will was on the second floor. This court reversed, saying the claim of no access is not enough. You did not prove what happened to the will or provide some explanation for the disappearance. And that's the same thing in Sutherland. This court, right after Bowery, reversed the trial court's decision that the will had been lost or taken. Why did they reverse? No evidence assigning or proving the cause to disappearance.
I'm wondering if the difference is not the character of the evidence, but the strength of the evidence. Because when you look at all these cases, you have different facts. And in one case, the court says, well, you didn't prove this. Well, is that saying that that's the character of the evidence that's required? Or is it saying, well, maybe, maybe not, but in any event, it wasn't of the strength necessary to be clear and convincing? I'm wondering if the standard throughout all these cases is really very simple. To rebut the presumption of revocation, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the testator did not destroy the will with the intention of revoking it. There's the standard. Now the question is, what is the proof that is acceptable to meet that standard? And the proof apparently moves from facts to facts and cases to cases. Isn't that how you actually resolve these cases?
I can only say that in the three post-Bowery cases and in the Jackson case, which is a pre-Bowery case, the court repeatedly says to rebut the presumption, you need to show, to assign is the word they use, some other cause for the disappearance of the will. That is the theme that you see in the paperwork. And this court has twice reversed since Bowery trial judges' determinations that evidence was met without assigning some other cause.
But some other cause could be that they just lost it, right? Or they misplaced it.
Well,
that could be a cause.
If all you had to do was prove it's not there, which is their argument, which I would suggest.
If you've got an explanation for it, that you can prove by clear and convincing evidence,
but
you win.
Right.
But if you can, yes, if you can provide some other plausible cause for the disappearance, but that's not what happened here, number one, and
well,
number two.
It's a factual question. Right now we're trying to deal with the legal standard, right?
Yes, you have to, in my view, assign some other cause. Why did the seconds tick so fast when I'm up here? And not so fast when you're sitting back there.
That's rhetorical.
You're having fun when you're up here.
Well,
so much fun. Let me extend it just a little bit. I'm not suggesting, in response to your explanation, that all you have to do is to demonstrate that the will is missing. That certainly would not be enough. I don't think the cases support that either, because it's not clear and convincing evidence of the lack of intent to revoke. But in this particular case, you have two wills in the top file cabinet, and they are photocopies. Two wills, the wife's will and Mr. Edmonds' will, and they are, the originals are missing.
Yes.
Well, under the circumstances where at 28 days before his death, he's telling his friends what's in the will and his intentions. 28 days later, he dies, so there's corroboration of his intention. The originals are missing. Including his wife's original. Why isn't the plausible explanation for it, which is juxtaposed with the statements of his intent, that he took out the originals and he didn't know the difference between an original and a copy?
That's a speculation. Two, that statement 28 or so days ahead of time, or prior to that point, was in chit-chat in a car on the way to the golf course, a discussion prompted by Dr. Bell, who said on the way to the golf course something along the line, I don't really want my stepdaughter to inherit, so I'm thinking about redoing my plan. Mr. Edmonds says something along the lines of second wife, daughter, get everything. That is not a specific statement about the existence of the will. And we've also put in a lot of evidence of Mr. Edmonds' mindset that he really wasn't keen with the daughter acquiring two businesses that takes some type of specialized knowledge, and she was within a year of attaining that age of inheriting if both passed away. That evidence came from at least two people.
All right. Well, your time has expired. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Griffin T. Garnett III. I represent the appellee, Elizabeth Cashman Edmonds. Seated at the table with me is Michael Holleran, who represents the appellee, Kelly Edmonds. And by agreement, I'm going to present the argument on behalf of the appellees. To reverse the trial court and to treat Jimmy Edmonds as dying intested, I submit to Your Honor that three extraordinary steps would have to occur, none of which I submit the court should do. Number one, the court would have to rule at least one prior case in this court, the Bowery case and possibly the Jackson case. Number two, the court would have to ignore important persuasive facts. And number three, the court would have to ignore the applicable standard of review. By reviewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant, and I submit to Your Honor that the court should not do that, and should affirm trial court's ruling. As in many of these lost will cases, there really is no dispute about the due execution of the contents of the will. And it's interesting that Jackson case tells us that where it's impossible for us, the proponents, to say what happened to the will, all that we need to show by a clear and convincing standard is that he didn't destroy the will with the intent to revoke it. And Jackson also tells us on the next page that the best evidence of that, the best evidence of his mindset, is through his declarations and through his acts.
Is this fair, counsel, that your position is that the rebutting case doesn't have to prove anything positive? It just has to disprove a negative. That is, he had no intent. But it doesn't have to prove what happened to it at all, as long as you can prove that the disaffirmance presumption is obviously not true.
The instruction that was approved in Brown says that. And also in the subsequent case, the Johnson case, which says where the will can't be found, the burden is on the proponent to prove that the will was, and this is an interesting phrase, just lost and not revoked by the testator. The model jury instructions, and I understand that has some precedent, but maybe yes, maybe no, say to overcome the presumption, talking about presumption of revocation, the burden is on the proponent to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the decedent did not revoke his will. Your Honor, we submit that's what we've done here. I'd like to call the Court's attention to a couple of comments in the appellant's reply brief, because this is our chance to respond to it. On page 2, he said that this Court has rejected the logic in Bowery in 3 subsequent cases. I submit to Your Honor that, respectfully, that's not true, and as I think Justice Goodwin pointed, in the Sutherland case, the Court approved the evidentiary record in both Browery and in Jackson. In page 3 or 4, he talks about creating oral wills. Well, I don't think we've made that argument at all. The will in question was written, and the execution of it and the contents of it were not even disputed by him. He quotes on page 9 from Brown, but in the quote, there's missing a couple points that are key to us, and I think Justice Lemons referred to it. When he's talking about the cause, proving causes, and he highlights, bear with me, proved by clear and convincing evidence that the will was not destroyed by the decedent, but was destroyed or secreted by some other person. Then there's an ellipse, dot, dot, dot. What is missing is the words from the case that what should be in here is with intent to prevent its probate or recordation, comma, or was lost or misplaced. Then at the end of the quotation in the reply brief is missing the words that came from the case and that she only had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the testator did not destroy the will with the intention of revoking it. He goes on the next page, on page 10, to say the Brown instructions do require proof by clear and convincing evidence that the will was destroyed by some other person. I submit to Your Honor, we don't need to prove that. If we show it's lost, if we can't explain what happened to it, as long as we show that he did not revoke it, or did not destroy it with the intent to revoke it. And then on page 10, he gives an example suppose Jimmy was careless and moved his papers around, etc. And when I read this, I thought, gee, that's interesting that careless people may be in a better position than someone who's careful. And I think this is a concession by him that lost is a cause. How do we prove loss? Well, we quote a Black's Dictionary, and maybe it's simplistic to say, cannot be found. But that language was also used in Johnson, which was the last case that says if the will can't be found, the burden's on us to prove that he did not destroy it with the intent to revoke. I'm going to move forward, if I might, Your Honor. The panel characterizes Jimmy's statements as generalized statements of intent or affection. I submit to Your Honor, they're statements of fact. Specifically, what is in his mind is a statement of fact. And the statement is, everything goes to my wife, everything goes to my daughter. In 2011, he meets with his financial advisor and brings the copies and says, in essence, this is my will. Thereafter, he repeated these statements, and 3 weeks before he dies, he and his wife have a conversation in Florida, after he's come back from Virginia, in which he says, we need to go back and see Mr. Manning, the person who prepared the wills in question, and we need to take the steps to carry out what's set forth in our 2002 will. Certainly, this is not an indication that he destroyed the will with intent to revoke it.
Now, those steps were funding the trust, right?
Well, they were not only funding the trust, I think he needed to change, he needed to create an LLC, he needed to retitle some of the stock.
None of the evidence led to, that I saw on the record, has anything to do with the change in his disposition.
No, that's right. To me, it affirms our position that, hey, our will needs us to do the following thing, and this is 3 weeks before he dies.
Well, interesting as well is that this is not just a statement of intention. This is a statement of fact that it is in his will, and that his will exists, and the original is in the drawer.
That would be my position as the court. One other point that I think is real key here, and some of the other cases talk about it, is we put on evidence that there was a diligent search for this, for these original documents, and they could not be found. And so that goes back to what's the definition of loss? Could not be found. A couple other things. In his assignment of error number one, he makes the point that the judge did not use the right standard. Well, I think the record clearly reflects that Judge Newman, both in his oral findings and his orders, found by clear and convincing evidence. Then the appellant says, well, he used the term, it's a close case. There's a criminal case where the very same language was used in finding the defendant guilty. That was upheld on appeal. And I looked at this, and maybe this is a wrong way of looking at it. I look at this like a pole vaulter or a high jumper. If the bar is set at clear and convincing, and I cross it, it matters not whether I cross it by an inch or by 2 feet. I can't tell from the assignment of error whether he's saying we can't prevail on just oral statements of the deceased. But I suggest to the court you really don't need to decide that because we've got oral statement plus a whole lot of other things. Both the originals were lost. Photocopies were right where he said his wills were going to be. The witnesses could see that they had a close, loving relationship. He had no relation with his son, obviously. He presented his documents to his tax advisor. And he always took the time and paid the money to have a lawyer to redo his estate documents. It doesn't make sense that he would tear something up when in the past he used a lawyer. Your Honor, it's our position that how the will was lost or misplaced, we can't say and we don't need to say. I think the instruction in Brown v. Hardin tells us that. And I think going back to Jackson, and I view Jackson as kind of a seminal case, where we can't explain what happened, sometimes the best that we can do is to show that he did not destroy the document with intent to revoke it. In Bowery, and he calls Bowery an outlier. Interesting, he doesn't say that the facts in Bowery are stronger than our case. I would submit to you that the facts in our case are stronger than in Bowery, because in Bowery there was at least one witness who said that the testator had some questions about redoing her will shortly after she had done one. In our case, there is absolutely no evidence that Jimmy ever said, I've destroyed my will, I want to destroy my will, I'm unhappy with my will. All that language is in some of the other cases, with the exception of Harris, that the appellant relies on. I'll be glad to go over... assignment number two, I think this is just a challenge to the evidence. Your Honor, I think we're entitled to the benefits that flow from that, from the decision of the trial court. There are numerous statements that he made in the record, and I submit that if a reasonable fact finder could find in favor of us, then this decision should be affirmed on appeal. With regard to a couple of the cases that Mr. DeMuro has cited, I would draw a factual distinction. Shacklett was a case, and I think the Jackson case said later on, Shacklett was a case of not a presumed revocation, but an actual revocation. Mr. Shacklett destroyed his will, and the question was he competent at the time he did it? But in Shacklett, there were numerous statements from the decedent that he was unhappy with his will, that he destroyed his will. That is also the case in Tate. That is also the case in Southern. Harris was a case where, as I read this court's ruling, there were inferences in favor of the proponent, There were inferences in favor of the contestant. They're equal, so therefore the proponent did not meet the burden by clear and convincing evidence.
Counsel, can you tell us how you would read Bowery to be consistent with the three post-Bowery cases that appellant has suggested are not consistent?
Well, the cases he's talking about, they did talk about signing signing and proving a cause for the disappearance. But Bowery was, and Bowery doesn't specifically say that, but Bowery did say, as I recall, that the complaint, or killer complaint, or whatever it was called back then, did allege that the documents were lost or misplaced. And I think from reading in the decision, although the court doesn't specifically say it was lost or misplaced, I think that's the finding in Bowery, and it goes back to Jackson, where we can't explain what happened to it. The fallback position is, if we prove that he didn't destroy it with intent to revoke, we're over the hurdle, we're over the presumption. With that, Your Honors, I would ask that you affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your argument. Call the next case.